All the Spivs I knew in Aberystwyth as a child in the 1960s and 70s lived inside my Auntie Getta's TV, a large teak box with four buttons glowing in her parlour. There was George Cole as Flash Harry in St. Trinian's, then George Cole again as Arthur Daly in Minder, and Arthur English, Prince of the Wide Boys. And of course, King Spiv for me, James Beck as Private Walker in Dad's Army.
Here, listen, I'll tell you what, Jonesy. I'll bring the van round to the back of your shop as soon as it gets dark. You help me load the meat onto the van, we'll take it to this mate of mine. He owns a restaurant. Yeah, now, don't look like that. He'll see you all right.
My first and only encounter with a real Spiv took place in Petticoat Lane in the late 1970s. I had an hour to kill before catching my train back to Wales, a green teenager, high on his first trip to London and the spiel coming from the traders. Then, between two stalls, this wizened cockney in a sharp suit asked me where I was from and, well, to cut a painful story short, within 5 minutes I was writing out a cheque for £30 for a canteen of cutlery full of blunt knives, sharp forks and Uri Geller spoons. It was like being hypnotised or being called up onto a stage as a child by a magician and almost colluding in the tricks. I still don't know how he did it, but I remember nodding at this strange, exotic creature as I drifted helplessly along the East End rapids of his patter.
Have a look at that half a dozen acres. These are not what the Spivs sell in the West End. Five for half a crown, one wash dustbin. Pity you blokes don't come in this tie game, I tell you that. That's why you've got nothing. You earn about £12 a week and you're satisfied. You want to turn your jobs up and have a go at this street game.
I'm talking today about the London Spiv. They exist elsewhere, of course, but the soul of the Spiv, for me at least, is resolutely cockney.
Could it be out to tell a tale like me, I'll tell you straight, you couldn't do it, none of you blokes.
One, two, three, four, five. Yeah, now these are beautiful anchors. Look, I don't have to talk about them like the Spivs have to. Look, I sell these for 8 and 6 a dozen. If you go in Woolworths or anywhere, they're 10p each at least.
Ever since I became Spiv fodder, I've been fascinated by the mystery of the Spiv, the chameleon craft of so many professions in one human being. Actor, comedian, hypnotist, mathematician, entrepreneur, fixer, public servant and not-so-green recycler. Perhaps something of ourselves stares back from his coat's hall of mirrors, something more than a flirtation with a darker world, something we aspire to.
And I swear by the Bible, I sold nearly 100 dozen yesterday here. Come and see me in a week, I bet you don't get near my stall. Now, I'm not a Spiv, I'm a clever man. I work for coppers and pennies and tuppences. I earn fourpence on a tie, I earn pennies on handkerchiefs, I sell thousands of them.
That was old Tosher the Tie, spiving about on Berwick Street Market. And I don't know about you, but I think he protesteth way too much about not being a Spiv. In this programme, we'll follow the Spiv along that fine line he walks between light and darkness, between lovable stereotype and true criminal. We'll ask where he came from and where he went to. That's if he's not dead. Oh yes, and we'll hear the tragic tale of the gruesome death of an actual Spiv. But let's begin with the word Spiv, which itself is a Spiv. Tricksy, evasive, its etymology pulls the wool over your eyes, ducks and dives beyond the laws of clear definition. Spiv, Romany for sparrow. Spiv, cockney backslang for very important person, or a police acronym for suspected person and itinerant vagrant. Or is it a derivation of spiffy, meaning smartly or flashily dressed? The Oxford English Dictionary records Spiv as the nickname for Henry Spiv Bagster, a London street trader and con man who made the national press circa 1900. These dodgy definitions are just a few of many, though for me, the combined image of a sparrow in a sharp suit making the most of stray crumbs does the trick.
Chapter 1. The Spiv. Where did he spring from?
The actor Alan Ford is well known for playing hard men in films like Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels and Snatch, where he played Bricktop. Alan was a young lad when the real actual Spivs were in their heyday in the late 1940s and early 50s, and I asked him to set the scene, to tell me how Spivs fitted into the post-war London bombscape, as it were.
Well, London wasn't just a garrison town, it was a garrison country. But, you know, every pub you went in, there were people in battle dress, and the guys that had been demobbed, the best they looked was wearing a demob suit, which was, like, pretty dour.
It was a very grey landscape.
And the Spivs were a bit of brightness to what was a monochrome world. They were known for having a suitcase, opening a suitcase, and they would have mostly, the big seller was nylons, of course. Every woman wanted nylons. You couldn't buy them. You couldn't buy clothes those days unless you had enough clothing coupons. Cigarettes. Everybody smoked in those days. Well, most people smoked, you know. So cigarettes were, like, priceless, but Spivs would always find a way of getting them. Meat was on ration right up until 1953. My first job as a butcher's boy was having to go and change the customers' ration books, you know, at the town hall. So it was still in practice in 53.
And did you have, like, a local Spiv?
I lived in Worth. It's East Street Market. And it's this market that runs from Worth Road right up to the Old Kent Road. And, of course, there were regular stallholders there, but every now and again, between them, unlicensed, somebody would prop up with a suitcase. I used to go to the Speedway. Speedway was very big in post-war London and all over England. And they would always be at the Speedway. And they would be the guys doing the three-card Monty, you know? I used to go dog racing, the New Cross Dogs. There would be Spivs there, and I would, you know, I wished I could have bought a suit like them or Also, don't forget, gambling was against the law. And so there were street bookmakers. But they were known, really, by their dress. That was a big thing, getting a flashy tie. And, of course, trilby hat, broad shoulders in their jackets. And it was their dress. It was a flash of brightness in this dull world.
So, the Spiv was crime's bright peacock and crime's public servant, able to put his hands on what you couldn't get and what you weren't supposed to have. In our days of relative plenty, it's hard to imagine being denied so many things. The Second World War marked the advent of rationing. Restrictions on imports and exports, along with a drive to produce materials for the war effort, led to this rationing of anything from food to clothing to petrol through the use of coupons which were recorded and inspected. A challenge for the Spiv.
As a very small boy, I do recall seeing people selling things out of suitcases in Oxford Street and my mother saying, get away from those Spivs.
I met Clive Emsley, a crime historian.
Just about every country in wartime in the 20th century has introduced a form of rationing. I mean, they have it in France, and you have a massive black market in France. And you also have the mass exodus from the big cities in France every weekend, what they called le peloton, the platoon of cyclists going out into the countryside to collect eggs and rabbits and chickens or whatever. Bit more difficult in England, but you do find that a place like Romford, which would have a market, produce would be brought in from East Anglia, and the boys from the East End thought, well, we're onto something here, lads. They started buying, for example, chickens, which were going to be used for breeding purposes, according to the piece of paper, and then slaughtering them and selling them as meat for the market. And it's something which is incredibly difficult to follow up.
So we're talking about a huge range of merchandise here, aren't we?
Yeah. Yeah,
we've had chickens and what
all kinds of clothing and petrol. I mean, what keeps armies and navies and air forces going is petrol. So petrol is rationed. I think people are limited to about 1,800 miles a year. But if you're doing work of national importance, you get rationing for 9,000-10,000 miles a year.
It seems that few, irrespective of class or status, were completely immune to the Spiv's temptations. The composer and actor Ivan Novello, whose wartime songs include the anthemic Keep the Home Fires Burning, famously said, "Things which do not require effort of some sort are seldom worth having." Well, petrol rationing was integral to the war effort, and those words would come back to haunt Novello, as Clive Emsley explains.
He was slightly concerned that he couldn't get back to his country residence in his Rolls-Royce with his chauffeur. And one of his fans said, "Oh, that's all right, Mr. Novello. I can arrange for you to have a certificate saying that you're travelling on work of national importance." And, of course, the whole thing was rumbled. And poor Ivor got... he was sentenced to 8 weeks in Wormwood Scrubs. He only served 4 weeks, which must have been absolutely shattering for someone like him. But his lady fans forgave him, because when he appeared on the stage after his sentence, allegedly he had a standing ovation just through walking on stage.
Well, thank God for that.
Absolutely.
Gather Lilacs by Ivan Novello, whose songs my mother used to sing to me, and whose petals were seriously burned by the Spiv's flames. And that story reminds us again how pervasive the black market was. You needed coupons for everything. And where there are rules, there are rule breakers. Sidney Day is a self-confessed former Spiv, and the author of a book of memoirs called London Born. He was interviewed for a BBC 4 documentary in 2005.
Very few of us knocking around at the Spivs, knocking around to sell stuff. There was plenty of buyers to buy it. If you had it, they used to buy it. You had no trouble in selling your stuff. And then on what you had, you could sell. I shouldn't think there's anybody in this country lived on their rations, not one person. They've all been in the black market somewhere along the line. I don't care who they are. Judges, police. You'd be a damn fool if somebody offered you a leg of lamb and you say, "Oh, no, I mustn't have that. It's black market." If you was offered it, bang, you went in with your head down and had it.
Frankie Fraser was definitely not a Spiv. Mad Frankie Fraser, as he's known, is in another league, having spent 42 years of his life in prison for various offences. Here he is, talking to criminologist Dick Hobbs in 1995 for a Radio 4 programme called Coupons and Nylons.
Coupons were used for everything during the Second World War. Now, were they an alternative form of money? How were they used?
They were better than money. Better. Because if you can see that cabinet there, and if you filled that up with coupons, you'd be a millionaire. And it ain't exceptionally big, because there's sheets and sheets and sheets. It's how you would get them in the sheets first, when you'd nicked them at the town halls, and then it would go into the books, would make it a little bit more bulkier. And they'd bite your hand off to buy them off you. Wonderful. I wish I could put the clock back. And there was no stink in the papers hardly at all about it, just a little bit. Because then they didn't like frightening the public. And also, as the war was nearly finished, still on, it was unimportant, wasn't it? Are we winning the war was more important, not someone nicking 6 million coupons.
There are the statistics of offences against the defence regulations. Now, defence regulations covers an enormous range, from blackout to black market regulations.
Clive Emsley again.
Rationing is introduced at the very beginning of the war. You see quite a dramatic increase in the proportion of offences against these defence regulations. The end of 1941 through to early 1944. Then you get another upsurge in 1947 and 1948 when rationing is continued. And I think 1947, 1948 is really the classic time of the SPIV. But I think the general feeling is, hey, the war's over. It's been over for a couple of years. Why are we still having to have food and everything else rationed? This isn't on.
Needless austerity.
Needless austerity. Whereas you have a Labour government which, you know, is actually... It doesn't see it as needless austerity. It wants a kind of command economy.
They were a child of economics. Robert Hanks is a writer, critic and broadcaster.
If you look, The Spectator, they had a lot of articles after the war where SPIVs are mentioned as products of socialism. They're disgusting creatures because partly it's about the new welfare state where everyone thinks they can get something without working. So it's interesting to see that rhetoric was at work 70 years ago. But also, of course, it's socialistic controls on prices that make it possible for the SPIV, the black marketeer, to exist. So he is an economic category, and the freer the market gets, the less room there is for the SPIV, the person who's kind of circumventing the rules, who's weaving a little bit around the place.
This is the BBC Home Service. Here is the news. Details of the new cuts are announced tonight in a statement from 10 Downing Street. The meat ration is to come down from one and tuppence to a shilling. The basic petrol.
So just when you might have thought the end of the war would ease rationing, the opposite happened. The war effort had taken its toll on industry and production at home. Much of export business had been lost. And then there was the end of the lease-lend scheme, where the US had provided materials to the UK. Problems were further compounded by the terrible winter of 46-47, which affected potato and wheat crops, and also put an extra burden on coal and electricity supply. Here's our retired SPIV, Sid Day, again.
I was laying in Kip, and I thought to myself, come on, blimey, you can't get potatoes, you can't get it. I thought to myself, I wonder if old Williams has got any potatoes up there. When Cocker came up, I said, we're going up and see the William brothers. He said, what for? I says, potatoes. It took us, hours to get there through the ice. And we got up to the house and old William says, what are you after now then? I said, what do you mean, what am I after? I said, I wanted to know if you got a few potatoes for us. He said, a few potatoes? I said, yeah. He said, yeah, he said, but they're on licence. He said, you know you're not allowed to sell them. I said, well, we're not allowed to do a lot of things, are we, Mr. Williams? I said, but we do them, don't we? I had 40 tonne of potatoes off him altogether. I think I sold about half of them to fish shops and greengrocers between Barnet and North Finchley, all on the black market.
There were global price rises too in 1947. Here are extracts from Prime Minister Clement Attlee's speech delivered on the 10th of August of that year. No doubt the SPIV was all ears.
I have a heavy responsibility upon me, but you have too. You all know the serious economic position of our country and the drastic steps which the government is taking to overcome our difficulties. The measures which we are taking will affect everybody. This is a situation as serious as any that's faced us in our long history. We must therefore act vigorously and drastically. To do this, we must delay providing ourselves with many things that we should like, in order that the materials and labour may be made available for the things we must have. Just as in the war we had to devote our energies to producing guns, aeroplanes and other weapons, and had to stop making other things, so today we must concentrate on what we need to win victory on the economic battlefield. The government is determined that nothing shall stand in the way of our recovery. To do this we require a national effort comparable to that which we developed during the war. I know how great a burden has been and is being borne by the women in our homes. would not be human if they did not grumble a bit. But I'm sure that they'll continue to show the patience and cheerful acceptance of difficulties, as they have done in the past. The nation will need, just as it did in the war, the work of women on the land and in industry, if we are to raise our production. There's the need for all of us as citizens to make as little demand on the national resources as possible, to avoid waste, and to add whatever we can to the nation's wealth. I have tried to set before you the facts of the situation, because I know that if you are told the facts and what must be done, you will respond. The way out of our difficulties is hard, but there's no alternative.
What do you feel about bread rationing?
Some. It's better than waiting until the winter time when we get none, isn't it? I'm quite satisfied with the bread rationing.
And what do you feel about
it? I'm just afraid I won't get enough. That's all.
But you are getting some now, aren't you?
Oh, yes, yeah, we're getting some, certainly.
What's your objection to the scheme, then?
None, I don't understand it, and that's all. I just hope I get enough. I should be satisfied, eh? As long as I can get a loaf a day, I should be all right.
What do you think about bread rationing so far today? Have you heard?
he's lost an inch in his belt already this morning.
A philosophical approach from those members of the public on the first day of bread rationing in 1946. And before that, we heard Attlee's speech, which included the line, "There's no alternative." Never a popular utterance from a politician.
And the fuel minister yesterday, he showed the way to economy. He didn't put any fire in his speech. In fact, he left the house so cold he should have put his speech in the fire. Mr. Attlee sent me two tickets for his new comedy when Parliament reassembles. Cigarette situation's so bad, isn't it? England seems to be all ifs and no buts. You know, any day I expect to pass a cigarette kiosk and see someone selling cigarettes, tuppence a puff.
A peeved Charlie Chester there in 1948 from an edition of his highly popular radio show, Stand Easy. It's also human nature, of course, to seek out the blue patches in the clouds. Or should that be the spiv-like silver linings?
We present Tony Hancock, Sidney James, Bill Kerr, Hattie Jakes and Kenneth Williams in...
Hancock's Alpha.
Here's a clip of Hancock from the late 50s and a conference of spiffs led by Sid James celebrating the return of petrol rationing.
Hey, here's a letter from Sid James. I recognise the handwriting.
Show me. Fivepence postage due. Yes, that's from Sid.
Hello. It's an invitation. Messrs. Hancock and Kerr. Oh.
You are cordially invited to a party given by Sidney James and Associates to celebrate the return of petrol rationing. Evening dress, prison record optional. Dancing to Busker Bertie in his Mayfair rock and rollers.
Hey, petrol rationing, that's a funny thing to celebrate.
Not for Sid's lot. Those spivs have been waiting for something like this for years. Most of them haven't worked since the nylon shortage. Given them new hope, this has. They got a brand new line of rackets to brighten their lives. Makes me feel sick, people cashing in on the national crisis.
We're not going, then.
Of course we are. Free banquet and a booze up, don't be a mug. What a mob. Look at them. All sideboards and shoulder pads. They got no idea, have they? And painted ties with evening dress. Not right, you know.
Still, the food's pretty good, though, isn't it?
It should be. They hijacked the lorries that were taking it to the Russian embassy reception. No, thank you. No, thank you. No more caviar for me, mate. I've got a bucket full here. I haven't touched it. Hang on, though. I'll have a handful of the pâté de foie gras. Just look at that big bloke over there, with all the razor scars. Look at him! Face like a strip of contemporary wallpaper.
I didn't know there were so many spivs in London.
These aren't all of them. These are just the shop stewards. This is the cream here, the sort of elected representative, so to speak. Each of these are here on behalf of about 50 men. See the little plaques in front of them, just like the United Nations, see? Bethnal Green pickpockets and allied workers. Crouch End safe breakers. Hammersmith forging, engraving and clerical workers. They're all here.
Where's Sid?
Place of honour. He's the chairman this year. He makes a speech of welcome when the nosh is finished.
Mr. President, Mr. Commissioner, your worship, my lord, ladies and gentlemen, we are assembled here tonight to celebrate the return of petrol rationing. I'm sure we all agree this is the most heartening news we've had for many years. Now, I'm optimistic that we will now make up for these terrible years in the wilderness. Years of plenty, no rationing, no black market, years of extreme hardship to all of us gathered here tonight. All right, then. For many years now, since the end of wartime rationing, many of us have had to scrape a living out of seasonal items like walnuts, pumped-up oranges, turkey raids on outlying farms. Some of us have even had to stoop as low as selling funny-shaped balloons.
You, for a start.
Do you mind?
I'm sorry.
Of course, we've been grateful for the few bright spots. Cup finals, test matches, Liberace concerts. And if it hadn't been for the Bolshoi Ballet, we'd have all been up the creek. Thank you, gentlemen. But now the tide has turned. Like a shaft of light cutting through the bleak darkness comes petrol rationing. And it is with tears in my eyes and my heart bursting with happiness that I tell you that we can now look forward to a good 6 months fiddling.
Chapter 2. The Spiv. A Jolly Good Fellow. Really? Hardly.
The Spiv infiltrates literature, radio, film and TV. Sometimes as an innocent fool, and other times as a dark and dangerous villain. And the real Spiv walks that tightrope between light and shade constantly. But the archetype I, like so many others, would prefer to believe in is that of the fool more than the villain. And if that's because we somehow need to forgive or exonerate ourselves from being complicit in the Spiv's historical misdemeanours, then so be it. Let's have a laugh.
The first time I saw a Spiv lampooned was Arthur English.
Actor Alan Ford.
He was a lovely character, actor. But he first was a comedian, and first time I saw him on BBC television, it may have been Sunday night at the London Palladium or something like that, and he turned up with a wheelbarrow and this great big tie with a big Windsor knot, and the tie went right down to his knees, and he had a trilby hat, and I think he had that little moustache, wide shoulders, and lots of Cockney, broad Cockney patter. But it was a lampoon caricature of the real thing, you know.
And finally, here is a gentleman who always has something to sell, be it jokes, nylons, or the whole of Billy Turnant's orchestra. The Prince of the Wide Boys, Arthur English.
Yes, mum, they love me. Mum, they're laughing at me again. I've got to laugh on you geezers and geezeresses tonight, though, I tell you. No, but this, my house business. The wife is looking after the furniture in arrangements of the house. She wanted a walnut bedroom suite. But I said, not likely. You seen the price of walnuts? Nothing to it, nothing either. I'm working as well, though. I'm doing my bit. I'm shifting the grandfather clock. I've got it over my shoulder, going round the road. Some smart geezer comes up. He said, here, boy, what's the idea of the grandfather clock? Wouldn't it be easier to wear a wristwatch? I said, don't be ignorant, boy. I can't tell the time. I go by the chimes.
Arthur English, with one of the best-known and enduring Spiv acts. Now, whilst our Spiv is resolutely Cockney, he's also resolutely male. Though, here's a charming song, Lady Spiv, sung by Greta Gint, who was actually born and raised in Norway.
When a lady ain't no lady, and her company is shady, though she may be in her heyday, she's a shady lady. boisterous. That's no novice from the cloisterous. She's a shady lady, Spiv.
A shady, gentle lady, Spiv. Each day is payday.
But you've got to give, give, give. When a lady's solid platinum, pearls and mink and don't look fat. Grinning like a Cheshire cat, she's a shady lady, Spiv, lady, Spiv, lady, Spiv.
Robert Hanks, why did we take to the character of the Spiv in culture so readily, do you think?
I think it's important to say that we didn't at first. That to begin with, in the war, the Spiv was a rather condescended to and even actively disliked character. So I think the film that's generally acknowledged as the first Spiv film is Waterloo Road, which is 1943, and John Mills is the upstanding British soldier who goes AWOL, leaves his unit because he's had a letter from home saying that his wife is hanging around with Ted Purvis, the local Spiv. And he's played by Stuart Granger. He's terribly good-looking. And he's a boxer, but very proud of the fact that he's emerged from the ring with all his features intact. But despite being so tough, he's got himself a phony certificate to say that he's got a heart problem, so he can't go in the army. So he's a coward, and the Spiv is regarded as someone who's not helping with the war effort.
Even my favourite Spiv, James Beck's private walk in Dad's army, had a hint of the draft dodger about him. His reason for avoiding call-up was that he had an allergy to corned beef. So, the ambivalence prevails, a kind of double standard in judgment, the disdain of cowardice alongside an admiration for the Spiv's guile. Here's a clip from the film Waterloo Road. Alistair Sim is a doctor attending to the soldier John Mills, who's just been injured in a fight at the Lucky Star Club, run by the Spiv villain Ted Purvis.
Not the first time there's been a bust up at Ed Lucky Star place. Beginning to think I ought to pay a commission to the fellow that runs it. What's his name, Purvis, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ever met him?
Not yet. Why?
Just a perfect example of the type that's determined to have his cake and eat it. Extraordinarily popular with the local lads. And lasses.
Why do you keep going on about Ted Purvis?
He interests me. He's a symptom of a general condition. Head down, please. Hope he's still not having his cake and eating it when the war's over.
Finished?
You know, Coulter, I sometimes think the remedy is in your hands.
What are you driving at?
I mean the hands of the people that you represent. You're making the sacrifices, you fellows in the services. You don't want the Ted Purvises of this world to reap the benefits when it's all over. Or now, for that matter. I don't know who's going to stop them. It's not you.
Look, Doc, do you know about...
My dear fellow, I was only thinking aloud. Any fool can punch somebody in the nose. It doesn't require any intelligence. But the point is, does it achieve anything? Does it do any good? I think it would do Ted Purvis a lot of good.
Thanks, Doc.
There'll be no charge.
Alistair Sim, taking the moral high ground on our behalf in Waterloo Road. Robert Hanks told me about his favourite Spiv film.
There's this fantastic old woman in They Made Me a Fugitive. Griffith Jones is Narcy, short for Narcissus, the very good-looking, well-dressed, very pleased with himself Spiv. And he runs Valhalla Funeral Parlour.
This way. The late Mr. Dabcock, I presume.
Dabcock. Alfred George, 21 Poplar Street.
He was playing croquet yesterday, not a care in the world. Sic transit. Gloria Mundi.
God. Poor stoner suffering duck. Ruddy near tore my arm holes out. Wait a blooming time.
Every time they bring a coffin in, it's full of cigarettes or... bits of meat off the ration book, you know, stuff like this. And every time there's a little old lady weeping behind in a very refined accent, she says, only yesterday he was playing croquet. So happy. And then they get in, and she's got this northern accent. She says, oh, sees the cigarette, she says, save me 200. My boyfriend smokes like a chimney. Oh, and the other one is they bring in some meat, and she says, oh, my boyfriend loves a bit of mutton. And they say, what, dressed as lamb?
But the goods weren't always as innocuous as meat or cigarettes. In this clip, the spiv genre crosses from light comedy to a much darker, shadier side of the street. Trevor Howard, as Clem, is horrified to hear that Narcy has taken delivery of a consignment of drugs, or, as he calls it, sherbet.
Everything here? Don't look like much. 700 nylons, Limpy said.
Yeah, you can't trust Limpy further than you can see him with your eyes shut.
What are you looking for?
Bed bugs.
Everything's there.
Who said it wasn't? Ah, there's the stuff that builds bonny babies, me boy. There's more Mazuma in that there parcel than you'll see in a month of Foggy Fridays.
What is it?
Sherbet. Huh. No coupons.
Since when have you been handling that stuff?
What's the matter with you?
I never agreed to meddle with that muck.
This is just a special job for a friend.
Are there going to be any more?
I wouldn't say yes, and I wouldn't say no.
Well, you'd better make up your mind.
Come off it. Anyone would think this was a peace conference.
I don't think I know what you mean by that, Clem. If there's any minds to be made up around here, they ain't going to be mine. I ain't an amateur mucking about for the fun of it. I built up this business from nothing, and I'm the boss. If I want to peddle sherbet, I'll peddle sherbet, even if it hurts your finer feelings.
I think the spiv was demonised to begin with because he represented something that people kind of wanted. He was the coward and the sexual predator and the man who was getting something for nothing at a time when we knew that was wrong in the war. And I think maybe after the war he became something we all were. People were felt free to acknowledge that self-indulgent, slippery side of themselves. Post-war, everyone's fed up with rationing, and there's a real resentment. I mean, especially, I think, after the summer of 1947, when rationing was tightened up quite a lot. Very hot summer as well. I think that's Passport to Pimlico comes out of that time, when everyone's really fed up with having to make do and have your ration book and the queues and all of that. And at this point, the spiv becomes more sympathetic because everybody wants his services and everyone's buying the knockoff nylons and the, you know, the meat that's off the ration books and the bit of scotch that's got a phony label on it. And then there are these films which are referred to as the spiv cycle. There are about 10 or a dozen, and it's quite a baggy category. So sometimes Brighton Rock is in... Well, very often Brighton Rock is included as one of these films, although...
Pinky Brown.
Yeah, I mean, clearly none of the characters in there is a spiv in the sense in which we're understanding it. They chance the guy who's a little bit fly, a little bit woo. They're much more hardened criminals, and Pinky's an actual psychopath, and he's a real thug.
Yeah, he's not a spiv. I'm finding it hard to, even in literature and in film, to sort of get a clear handle on the spiv, whereas, you know, perhaps in comedy... It's easy.
I think it is partly because he is an archetype. He's a set of very clearly defined narrow characteristics. So it's actually quite hard to make a character out of that. British films of the 1940s tended to be wedded to the idea of the primrose path to perdition or, you know, the slippery slope. So you can't just be a spiv. You know, once you've entered the life of crime, you're on a slow track towards murder and the noose. You know, it's you're on your way to damnation. So the spiv, although he's, you know, in real life, probably quite a petty criminal, he's going to stay stuck as a petty criminal. In films, he gets involved in much worse stuff.
But is it true that the real spiv is this benign figure? Or have I just been hoodwinked into swallowing the myth? Here again are Clive Emsley and then the actor Alan Ford.
I think, basically, a spiv is not a violent individual. Some spivs are involved in pretty significant robberies of things like ration books, identity cards. I mean, there was a joke that a spiv's name depended upon which pocket he went into for his identity card.
Were they as innocent and harmless as...
Well, of course they weren't. They weren't innocent. No, they weren't innocent. They were out... If they were selling bent gear, they were selling gear people wanted. Of course they weren't innocent, no. But if a fight breaks out, a spiv is the first one under the table or out the door. He doesn't want to get involved in violence. He may well be selling the proceeds of some violent act, but he wouldn't be performing anything himself. He would be the first slippery bastard out the door.
And what did Frankie Fraser, real-life villain, think of the spiv? Here he is in 1995.
They really were sort of laughed at by the proper thieves. They was, really. They was considered a bit of a joke. I don't mean that nastily.
Perhaps that's why I like them, spivs. Their gentility in the face of violence. And, of course, their capacity to screw up. It's becoming clear that if the spiv himself was not violent, then the opposite is true of many whose company he needed to keep. And before we move on to the metaphorical death of the spiv, or not, let's put the spiv's dodgy dealings into true context with a chilling story of the murder of a real spiv.
Chapter 3, The Death of a Spiv, a True and Gruesome Story.
Food and petrol rationing aside, the used car business was a magnet to the spiv's skills in persuasion. I've come to Warren Street at the northern edge of London's Soho district, which for much of the 20th century was humming and choking with car showrooms, serving as a kind of catwalk and kind of gentleman's pavement club for spivs. And I'm here with historian Rob Baker. Rob, you're going to share with me a rather grisly tale, but first of all, where are we actually standing now?
We're outside Pall Mall Barbers, which used to be known as the Fitzroy Cafe. It's on the corner of Fitzroy Street and Warren Street. And in here, it used to be used as an office by a man called Solomon Setti. And his name around here, to everyone he knew, was Stan the Spiv.
So what was his business?
Stan the Spiv had become bankrupt in the 1920s. He wasn't allowed to open a bank account. He always just dealt in cash, and he was known as a curbside banker.
He was very well liked in Warren Street, all round. If anybody wanted to borrow £1,000, and he knew them, they could borrow it with no questions, no arguments or anything.
That was the voice of Charlie Fryer, a friend of Setti's, recorded for a TV documentary in 1972. Early in October 1949, Stan the Spiv Setti, so much a fixture of Warren Street in Fitzrovia, went missing. 14 days later, on the Dengie mudflats in Essex, Sidney Tippin was out in his boat shooting wildfowl.
Well, I hadn't been out long when I see it. Paddling across here, I see a parcel coming in with a tide. And that was the thing what kept upsetting the birds. Because they sit floating in, that was making them restless, what we call restless. Before I went in and wore and loaded my gun and had a smoke, and I was on my way home. I thought, well, there's that blinking thing I see coming in with a tide. I'm going to have a look at it. Of course, I pulled up, shoved up alongside on it and got a hole on it and cut it open. The cloth opened on the wall and that sunk, that was wet. I see that was a body, man's body of all. See, it was a body, so it floated out. I thought someone had been buried at sea and that floated in. Matter of fact, I was going to leave it. I thought, no, I'm going to tie it. Well, if it hadn't been for that morning I was down there and the wind and the world north and the birds was all that way, I went that way. If the birds had been on the other side, the right-hand side, I should have went south. And when I was coming back, I went to it and tied it on the eye water, right on the eye water. If I hadn't tied it, then that would have went straight right out to sea. Perhaps nobody had never found it.
Sidney Tippin had found a body in a parcel, a body with no legs and no head.
It had been estimated that it had been in the sea for about 2 weeks, and so it was incredibly difficult to identify. But there was a man called Superintendent Fred Cherrell who carefully carved the fingertips off the body and put them over his own fingers, and he managed to get fingerprints from that.
My God.
And from that, they managed to identify the body. They found out that it was Stan the Spiv.
And what happened next? Did they catch the person who did it?
On the 28th of October, they entered a house on the Finchley Road and they arrested a man called Donald Hume. And he'd met Stan at a club, the Hollywood Club, near Marble Arch, 2 years previously. And Setti was a large man. He looked like the typical spiv. He had expensive clothes on. He was a very imposing character. And Donald Hume later would actually describe him. He had a voice like broken bottles and pockets stuffed with cash. They very soon became business partners. You know, they were both sort of semi-criminal, and they dealt in black market petrol coupons and dodgy motors that Hume would steal. And then, after a quick respray with all Stan the Spiv's contacts, they'd sell on and make a lot of money that way. But there was one thing that Donald Hume had. He had a flying license. He was known in the London underworld as the flying smuggler. Hume in 1939 joined the Royal Air Force Volunteer Reserve, but after 2 years he had to leave. He had meningitis, but the RAF also said that he had a degree of organically determined psychopathy. He wasn't a pleasant man.
So perhaps, all things considered, it was on the cards that Hume would fall out with Setti at some stage.
I think it started with Hume's terrier dog had actually accidentally rubbed across one of Setti's recently resprayed cars. It was as silly as that. But soon the confrontation became physical, and Hume, never a person who could control his temper, suddenly reached up for an SS dagger that he kept on the wall above his fireplace, took hold of it and plunged it into Stanley Setti. He then obviously had to get rid of the body. It was 13 stone body, and he wrapped it in carpet felt. He hid it in a cupboard for a day while he wondered what to do. He wasn't so upset about killing Stanley Setti. He was upset about having to burn 900 five-pound notes that were covered in Stanley Setti's blood. 900 pounds. That's about £25,000 today. Later that day, Hume hired a car and took these felt parcels to Elstree Airport, where he hired a light Oster aircraft, and he flew up over the English Channel, and he started to try and push the parcels out of the door.
So he's chopped up his victim's body and put it onto an aeroplane, and he's flying up over the Channel?
Yeah.
Yeah?
But he had to take his hands off the control to open the door, and it took him ages, and in the end he had to push the last bit of body out of the car until it fell into the English Channel. And then he flew back to Southend Airport. And he hired a car from Southend Airport, which he stupidly paid with one of Setti's £5 notes.
One cool customer here. And that was his undoing.
It was. He'd been spending Setti's £5 notes, and the police started to find them around dog tracks around the southeast. And in those days, £5 notes were £150 today. And if you got one out of a bank, they wrote your name down with the number next to it every time you got a £5 note. So it was easy for the police to slowly track down Donald Hume, which they did. And they arrested him on the 5th of November, 1949.
The story doesn't end there, though. Hume blamed three others for Setti's murder, and at his second trial in 1950, he was sentenced to 12 years for the lesser crime of accessory after the fact. He served 8 and later, knowing he couldn't be tried twice for the same crime, sold his gory confession of the murder to the Sunday Pictorial. Hume later went to live in Switzerland, where he was found guilty of killing a taxi driver during a bank robbery. Declared mentally unstable by the Swiss authorities, he was returned to the UK in the late 70s and incarcerated in Broadmoor. Hume apparently dressed like a spiv for the Setti murder trial at the Old Bailey, but neither his daring nor his violence fit easily into the archetype. No match for the real criminal, the true spiv was Hume's gentler victim, Stan the Spiv Setti.
Chapter 4. The Spiv is Dead. Long live the Spiv.
60 years on from the Spiv's heyday, crime's public servant has shuffled off stage, all but vanished, or at least that's how it seems. Mention the word Spiv to anyone under 30, and they look puzzled. But it's not as if we don't still occasionally excuse spivish behaviour, or that we've lost an instinct to soften the sinister, or to make a pantomime of crime. I wonder if the Spiv's comic potential might be at the root of his decline. Here's Robert Hanks.
In a sense, I suppose the seeds of the Spiv's destruction as a social class, they do come post-war when he becomes a comic figure and he appears in cartoons and Sid Field is Slasher Green.
And then you get the
yeah, exactly, George Cole in the St. Trinian's films. And the Spiv, one thing about him, the Spiv is self-conscious. The Spiv is aware of his image. And he's projecting himself. So once the Spiv is a comic figure, he's kind of done for. If he can't, you know, seduce the girls with his sharp lapels because they think he looks funny, they think he looks like Sid Field or Arthur English, then he's done for. So he's got to find something else to do.
The late George Cole famously twice played spiv-like characters, first as St. Trinian's Flash Harry, and later on as...
Arthur Daly, in Minder. He's not a spiv, he's an entrepreneur. But probably when he was 24, 25, he was a spiv. And if you worked out, put all the programmes together and worked out just how much money he had lost, I mean, it runs into more than newspaper bingo. He's a total failure. And I think that's what makes them, one have affection for them. They keep trying and they always fail. And he's not a villain. I mean, whereas spivs were selling you things you couldn't get at prices you couldn't afford, Arthur Daly was selling you something you didn't want at prices you couldn't afford.
After Arthur Daly, the spiv's mantle, many would say, was assumed by Sir David Jason as Del Boy Trotter in Only Fools and Horses. Although some of Del's associates also had spiv-like tendencies, there was Patrick Murray's Mickey Pierce, who had the look of a spiv, and the late Roger Lloyd Pack's Trigger was a kind of slow-motion spiv in reverse. I wonder if the spiv's real demise, and possible reincarnation, was marked when Nicholas Lyndhurst, as Rodney Trotter in the series, donned the shiny stockbroker's suit of the 1980s. Either way, it seems that defining a spiv was becoming more and more difficult. I asked author and columnist Owen Jones to tell me why he thinks the real spiv, or even his spirit, has disappeared.
If I was to be mischievous, you could call the free market crusade unlaunched by Thatcherism as kind of institutionalised spivvery, whereby everybody is always encouraged to become a spiv. You pull yourselves up by your bootstraps, you draw on your own individual resources and frankly have very little interest for the wider social consequences of your actions. And it's about what you can do for yourself, even if that means cutting corners. So I suppose, you know, if we're going to push that to its extreme, then we live in a Britain of spivvery, which was encouraged and licensed by the Thatcherite crusade.
All the world's a spiv.
Everyone's a spiv now, yeah.
Robert Hanks again.
Well, I think that's the sort of other place when you can see the kind of spiv atmosphere might be in the late 80s when you suddenly get the East End, you know, supposedly the Barrow Boys ending up in the city with their red braces and their champagne lunches and flashing their wads of cash around.
Oi, you! Shut your mouth and look at my wad! Loads of money!
This is a journey into money. Loads of money.
It would seem that what was once discreetly stored in the lining of a spiv's jacket has more recently been shamelessly flaunted and flashed on its lapels. And, so far as pointing out today's spiv is concerned, the lines of definition are just not as sharp as Clark Gable's moustache.
Oi, mate. Don't park your car here, mate. It's not safe around here. Get nicked. It's mad round here. Another little word of advice, the briefcase. I'll tell you what, walking around without your advertising it. Don't get me wrong, I mean, you know, it's a nice area, but only takes one family, doesn't it? Unfortunately, round here is my family. Yeah. One man prime wave I am, do you know what I mean? I'll nick anything. I'm a little bit dodgy, tasty. I'm a geezer. I'll nick anything. So do yourself a favour, mate. Park somewhere else. God, you don't want me.
Chris the Crafty Cockney. Definitely more geezer than spiv. That particular Paul Whitehouse character may well be son of spiv, but what, I wonder, would his old man have made of the T-shirt and tracksuit bottoms? So, can we find him now?
And among the obstacles is the threat to recovery from a credit squeeze by banks on our small businesses. And on banks, I make no apology for attacking the spivs and gamblers who did more harm to the British economy than Bob Crowe could achieve in all his wildest Trotskyite fantasies.
The spivers banker? I'm not so certain that that meets the underdog specification in the spivs job description. One other modern-day comparison was suggested by Alan Ford.
The equivalent today I was called the local drug dealer. I'm not talking about, you know, the guys who are importing cocaine or whatever, but just the guy who lives under the tree. You want to buy a small amount of grass or a bit of ash. I would equate them to that, you know.
A spiv selling drugs? Alan may be right. After all, we heard Narcy peddling sherbet earlier in They Made Me a Fugitive. But again, I'm not so sure. For me, the spiv, if he's still out there, remains a romantic figure. Embroiled in crime, yes, but transcending its brutality, elevating it to performance art, even poetry. Christopher Marlowe might have known a spiv or two. Let's end this investigation into the spiv with a parody of The Passionate Shepherd to His Love, tracked down by crime historian Clive Emsley.
The Passionate Spiv. This is simply from The New Statesman, 27th of September 1947, and it notes that spuv is the female of the species in the original. Come spiv with me and be my spuv, and we will all the pleasures prove that markets black and rackets bring. Thou shalt not lack for anything. Thou shalt not queue, yet thou shalt see food manor-like rain down on thee. Attendant spivs shall ply the barrow through London's streets both wide and narrow to ease the toils of thy housewifery with a percentage from their spivery, and keep us safe from rivals' raids with their protective razor blades. If these delights thy mind may move, come spiv with me and be my spuv.
Wonderful.